I've been asked to talk about magnetic reconnection in flares. I extend that to include all solar eruptions, including coronal mass ejections, prominence eruptions. To me, from the theory point of view, they're all closely related. And also been asked to kind of summarize where we stand on this view. I'd like to start by just giving some general comments about how you kind of divide the problem up of solar eruptions and how reconnection comes into this phenomena. One aspect, which we discussed in some sense yesterday, although we didn't talk about it in terms of what it means for flares or solar eruptions, is the creation of currents in the corona. It's these currents, the magnetic field associated with these currents, that essentially is the energy that goes into the flare. And the kind of two paradigms that theory people tend to bifurcate into is one is to take a potential field, move the photospheric foot points around to create these currents. That was pretty popular about 10 or 15 years ago. The latest fad is now concentrating in the idea that you emerge flux ropes, the structures come up already with current. And I think it's almost certain that what's really going on is a mix of these two. But the theory people tend to, you know, always kind of do one or the other. Somehow, that current or the magnetic field associated with that current flowing in the corona becomes unstable, either due to an ideal MHD instability or a resistive instability, and we get an eruption. And that's kind of the big question mark in the field now, is what is the nature of that? That's been around for, I think, ever since flares were discovered, so for over 100 years, and it still has really not any good answer. And then once the eruption occurs, the one place we're fairly confident now that we see evidence for reconnection is in the relaxation of the field after it's erupted. And we have these classic structures of cusp-shaped flare loops. Yoko really confirmed that these were cusp-shaped. And then we have both the hot X-ray loops, cooler H-alpha loops below that, and then these loops have motions which are best explained by reconnection. So in terms of putting everything in the phenomena together, this is a kind of large eruption, which includes a coronal mass ejection, a prominence erupting, flare ribbons, flare loops. The whole structure basically is a disruption of the field. The field expands, flies out, it creates a shock wave. There's a pileup of plasma surrounding the erupted region, which is the kind of the classic observer CME that you see in a coronagraph. In many cases, but not all cases, the erupted field contains a prominence, which comes flying out. It can be at very high speed, but not necessarily. And then as this structure comes out, you see below it the formation of the X-ray loops and the ribbons. Now, in the whole phenomena of the flare, there are actually several roles that reconnection can play, at least possibly. But not all of these are observed. So I have kind of three roles here that people often don't think about these possibilities, especially the first one. It is at least conceptually, theoretically possible for reconnection to play a role in energy storage. Here's an idea that you have a potential field. You bring together slowly, before any eruption, before the flare, very slowly, fields together. You cancel them in the photosphere, that is, you reconnect them. And you can actually transfer energy via a pointing flux. You can transfer the kinetic energy of the photospheric convection up into coronal currents. Now, there's virtually no evidence, I think, at the moment that this actually happens, that this isn't all important. But I just want to point it out as a possibility. Something like this actually does happen, and it is important in something, a system like the Earth's magnetosphere, this reconnection as a mechanism for storing magnetic energy. Much more likely to be important, and kind of a good controversial area, is the possibility that reconnection acts as a trigger. A lot of people think that the eruptions are caused by some enhancement in reconnection. Here's a possibility. It's not something I particularly favor, but I just wanted to show it for illustration. You take an arcade, you shear it. As you shear it, you will create a force-free current along. And if you shear it enough, and it has to be a lot, which is why I don't think it's so realistic, you can create a rather thin current layer, which could, at least in principle, become tearing unstable. And the instability wouldn't start immediately. It would require something like the length of the sheet to exceed a well-known length for the tearing instability, basically 6 times its width, 2 pi times its width. Or there might be something to do with the current density. The current density might have to get to a certain value, and then some kind of anomalous resistivity would set in, which would cause the reconnection to take off. So that's reconnection as a trigger. And then finally, the third role, and this is where we have really all the evidence for reconnection occurring and where it's not really controversial anymore, is in its role in energy release and the recovery of the field. You could have, for example, some mechanism involving a loss of ideal MHD equilibrium. There's some 2D models that kind of work like this. They become unstable, or they lose equilibrium. Stuff goes flying out, and then you can create a current sheet during the eruption, and then reconnection starts in that sheet. Very closely related is the concept of loss of stability. You can twist a flux rope, get a kink, get reconnection again after the kink has formed. So let me just start now a little bit about trigger mechanisms. I mentioned this as a loss of ideal MHD equilibrium or MHD stability. You can frame this in terms of catastrophe theory. In terms of catastrophe theory, loss of equilibrium or the development of unstable equilibrium are essentially the same concept. And this idea has been around for a long time. I don't even think I know quite how long. I know it's fine papers going back to the 1950s. And there are many, many solutions where people try to find nose points, push the system in some way, and say, oh, it becomes unstable. But a lot of these solutions are actually not very physical. Either the nose points are just mathematical artifacts, or you have to do strange things at the boundary conditions, which are not at all like what the sun does. But it's the same idea, that you have some boundary parameter, you move something around on the surface, you get to some nose point, and then you have a catastrophe. That's a trigger which is not involving reconnection. The other idea, which has kind of been around for a while, is the idea that you have colliding loops. The original emerging flux scenario that Dave Rust and Dick Canfield and Eric Priest and some others were involved with was the idea that you push some flux up out of the convection zone into an overlying system. It's another system. You create a current sheet. As the current sheet develops, again, you can get this sudden change of the resistivity as the current density increases, so that the conductivity suddenly becomes much smaller, allowing rapid dissipation of the energy. Now, I tend not to favor that scenario anymore, primarily because of what you see in numerical experiments. These are 2D experiments, but nonetheless, what you see is that every time you start to create one of these current sheets, it tends to reconnect right away. It's actually hard, in a sense, to keep it there, to keep it from reconnecting all the time. When you push some flux, for example, in a box here, push it up into an overlying field. This green vectors here, the little triangles, are actually flow vectors, showing flow kind of coming down, going up into an X line here, and out a high flow speed jet coming out, which is actually greater than the fast mode wave speed, super magnetosonic with respect to the fast mode. That's that yellow region, so it's a super magnetosonic jet. When you do that, when you're pushing, you get a reconnection process which looks a lot what's called a flux pileup, where you actually slam the thing together, and you get a fairly fast rate. And when you use theory to scale it to realistic Reynolds numbers for the sun, it's still fast. And even when you stop pushing and let the system relax, you get something which looks more like Petchek. I won't say it's exactly Petchek, but again, it also scales very fast. So the impression you get from doing these simulations, even in two dimensions, is that the reconnection is always pretty fast, and that it's difficult to imagine that you would push something up and store it in a current sheet for days on end, and then suddenly it would release. It seems to want to dissipate the sheet almost immediately. So I think it's actually more likely that the currents in the corona are in the form of force-free fields rather than current sheets. Let's come back to this question of the reconnection rate, because that's kind of like always the number one question in any theory of reconnection, is to get it to go fast. And how fast do you need? Well, here's a kind of simple way to talk about the reconnection rate, is in terms of the energy. If you have an eruption and it comes from magnetic energy stored in the corona, then what you need in order to get out, say, a moderately large event like 10 to the 32 ergs of energy, you need something like, for example, a 70 Gauss field to reduce to 50 Gauss field on average in a volume of something like 6 times 10 to the 4th kilometers. And you can get a lot more energy than this if you want, just by doubling the volume, since the energy depends on the cube of the length scale here. So there's plenty of magnetic energy around. And if you take that length scale and relate it to a diffusion time scale, because reconnection involves the diffusion of the field through the plasma, the diffusion time scale is just the length scale divided by the magnetic diffusivity. Now, if you use collisional theory, which you can see from this exclamation mark right away you don't want to use, but if you do use it and put in what you would think is a collisional result for the diffusivity, you get an enormous time scale. You get this 300 million years for the time it takes to release the energy, if you just use that volumetric length scale. So, as has been going on for 50 years, you need to speed up the process. You need to get fast reconnection, and you have one of two mechanisms, which you can see immediately from this formula. One is to reduce the scale length. You invoke current sheets, or you invoke very tiny current sheets. Or, alternatively, you can change this number by invoking anomalous resistivity. The corona is not a collisional plasma, it's a collisionless plasma. So that collisional theory can't be used. And in reducing the scale length, you can ask then, well, how much do I have to reduce it to get down to, say, a reasonable flare time scale of 1,000 seconds? This is, say, for the impulsive phase of the flare, the beginning. Well, you could just work these numbers backwards again. It's the same formulas again. Now I'm solving for the length, plugging in the required time scale. If you use collisional theory again, you end up with an incredibly small scale length of 20 meters for the size of the structures, reconnection structures. And what might the structures look like? Well, there are various things that have been proposed. I actually tend to kind of favor this at the moment, is turbulence. Turbulence automatically creates lots of little tiny structures. That's the whole point of a cascade of turbulence, is to create small scale lengths where dissipation can occur rapidly no matter what the dissipation coefficient is. There's something called the X-type collapse, which was actually due to Dungey, proposed in 1954. Which is where you tweak a system, you slam it, and waves propagating toward a null point, the reconnection site, will create naturally a very small scale length. This process is also very fast because it has a small scale length associated with it. And then there's Petchek's steady state process, and one of his main points was that he could create a very tiny current sheet in the center of a structure with slow shocks. Now, 20 meters is incredibly small, and if you think of this in terms of anomalous resistivity, this was a number valid for collisional plasma. Well, the collisional mean free path for electron ion collisions along a field line in the corona is something like 10 kilometers, or maybe a little bit bigger than this. And so anything that was 20 meters and small certainly would not be governed by a collisional formula. It would have to be collisionless. So if you want to make an anomalous resistivity, how big can you do that? Well, essentially, again, solving this, playing with the same formula, now solving it for the resistivity instead of the length scale, You want to make the length scale as large as possible associated with the anomalous process. That can't be much larger than 10 to kilometers, because collisions prevent any larger length scale. So if you plug in kind of the maximum length, you end up with this result that the enhancement you can get from anomalous resistivity alone is about a factor of 10 to the 5 over the collisional value. Neither one of these processes, just reducing the scale lengths or just introducing anomalous resistivity of some sort, is sufficient to give you the fast rate. You really have to combine both of these. So people who argue that fast reconnection is due to small scale lengths, and others who say it all has to do with kinetic processes, we need them both. Everybody's got to help here. Yeah, the point is that if you reduce, you just take the MHD picture and you say, well, we'll keep the resistivity collisional and reduce it to the scale length, we end up with a scale length that's not consistent with collisional theory. So we're forced into the collisionless regime. If you take the point of view that we'll just do, we'll keep the large scale length and just do anomalous resistivity, and I mean that 4 times 10 to the 6 kilometer scale length, then we can only get an enhancement about 10 to the 5th, and this is not enough. We still need about another factor of 10 to the 5th. So it's really a struggle to get the rate fast enough to explain flares, to get that 1,000 seconds.
You can put it another way, because to have anomalous resistivity, you necessarily need small scales, because otherwise you will not have instability which triggers this anomalous resistivity.
Yes, you could put it that way as well. Okay, now let's actually get in a little more to the observations. This is one of the early Yoko pictures, and this is an event I think Hugh Hudson may have presented. There you are, Hugh. I think very early after Yoko's launch. I can't quite remember. I can remember you talking about this event at an AGU meeting.
This is his flare.
This is his flare, but I somehow remember you talking about it before I saw him talk about it. But it's an event which shows, this is a slide made for me by Lauren Acton, which shows the flare at a fixed intensity. That's why it's so hard to see in each frame. But you see this cusp-shaped structure coming up, and you see a what looks like a kind of like a trunk or stripe feature right through the middle of the cusp. And Hugh, I was thinking of your talk on this, because I think this was the event, or one similar to it, in which it said, oh, this looks just like a kind of a reconnection jet here, except there was one little problem with it, and that is that it was cool. And in fact, it was about twice as cool as the surrounding corona. And one of the things you expect reconnection to do is to heat things up. And it was a puzzle, kind of, why the structure was so cool. In fact, it gets cooler as you go toward the base here. And I think we kind of understand it, or at least that I think I understand it, what's going on there, because you can do numerical simulations, which include radiative effects and thermal conduction effects. I've done some work with radiation. Yokoyama and Shibata have done it with thermal conduction. And the conclusion you get to is that what you're seeing when you look at an image like that is that you're seeing an erupted field reconnecting. The field lines here are these dotted lines are kind of faint. The solid lines are the actual plasma structures you observe. The field lines reconnect, and in the simulations, you see actually a much longer current sheet than this, but you have a downflow and upflow, and you have slow mode shocks, more or less like Petchek predicted, only that they're isothermal because of the strong thermal conduction along field lines. And you have a conduction front which maps from the slow shocks down to the chromosphere, and it's the conduction of energy along these slow shocks down into the chromosphere that leads to an evaporation, which pumps material back up into the system. Now, when you do this in simulations, or you can look at it analytically as well, the net result of this evaporation is to increase the density in the lower loop system by a factor of 100 over the ambient corona. This is why you only see the lower part of the structure. You don't see the upper part so well, although just now, I think David McKenzie may show you this afternoon some images where you begin to see some of this current sheet structure. But generally, you just see this stuff because it's so dense. And it also nicely accounts for the temperature. When you put the magnetic energy into that dense plasma, you come out with about 30 million degrees Kelvin X-ray loops, which fits nicely with the observations. And in the simulations, you have about a Mach 2 jet. That's Mach 2 with respect to the fast mode. Because it's supermagnetosonic, you can get a fast mode jet termination shock here. And then that shock, and also the slow shocks, because they enhance the density by about a factor of 5, that causes the radiative cooling in this region below the shock to become enhanced considerably over the surrounding area. So you start getting thermal condensation to occurring because of the radiative properties of the corona. It's thermally unstable, and you start getting condensations forming, and that eventually leads to the formation of the cool 10,000 degree H alpha loops. And this is what a real kind of simulation looks like. It's done a long time ago, so I have trouble finding good graphics for it anymore. But this is a plot of the reconnecting field lines. This is the current density. The reconnection is kind of going in here, and you can see this bifurcation of the current sheet into slow mode shocks. All of this current density structure down here is due to the condensations which are forming. This is a plot which also shows the shocks very nicely. It's the vorticity. The slow shocks are basically rotational discontinuities, and so they show up very nice in a vorticity plot. And one thing you'll notice also in these simulations, which is even more true in 3D, is that there are often multiple X lines, and the sheet tends to become turbulent. It tends to be bubbly. And I won't go into all the details here, but just say there are Petrec shocks. There's also some current layers downstream, which are reminiscent of a solution by Sierovsky for reconnection. You also see in the simulations, and also again from compressible Petrec type theory, that you don't always get this downward jet. If the reconnecting plasma has a strong magnetic field, that basically means a plasma beta much less than 1, and in the simulations it needs to be like 0.1 or even 0.01 to make it really happen, you will get that. You'll see the flow coming into the X line in two jets, more or less symmetrically going up and down, and that was the structure I was showing in the previous view graph. But if you get a high beta plasma, and in a real eruption, the reconnection site is rising all the time, so eventually you can end up in a situation where the magnetic fields are not so strong because you're so far away from the sun. When that happens, the jets are no longer supermagnetosonic, they're submagnetosonic, and the reconnection structure senses the presence of the photospheric boundary down here. So the flow comes in, and most of it is deflected upwards. Very little of it wants to go downwards. And that whole structure collapses, and you end up with the disappearance of the condensations. You see that in the simulations. If the magnetic fields are not strong enough, the flow structure changes, the condensations below the jet stop, and you just have a simple loop with no trunk structure in it. And that event I was showing you with the trunk structure, if you look at it long enough, that trunk eventually disappears. It's not there except early on. I mentioned this motion of the loops and ribbons. Let me just focus on that, because this is one of the key things, key aspects of the observations that really, more important than the cusp shape, has convinced people of the reality of reconnection during the recovery phase of flares and CMEs. And that's the simple fact that when you look at these ribbons, they appear to move across the sun. Yet when you look at the fibrils and structures within the ribbons, they're not moving. It's not a real plasma motion. They tend to light up. They light up for a few hours, and then the ribbons move past them, and they fade away. So the interpretation of that has been that you have a reconnection site at one point in time, which, say, maps to the point 2, the field line 2 on the sun. 3 is an open field line. 2 is reconnecting. 1 is something that's already closed. As time goes on, the plasma moves through the X line. The field line that was there at the X line is now below it. A field line that is open is now reconnecting. And so this outer motion of the ribbon corresponds to the separatrix, that is the field line which maps to the reconnection site, to the X line. And so that emotion of the ribbons, and the upward motion of the loop is an apparent motion. And when you do Doppler shift analysis of, for example, the H-alpha loops, and you look at them, you see that material is always flowing downward. Even though the loops appear to move up, there is no real plasma motion going upward in here. It's always redshifted downwards. And this is a typical trajectory of how the ribbons separate. They separate very quickly at first, and then they slow down with time.
Some of that is determined by the local structure they run into other
microfields. Indeed. Yeah, and there's more to this in the sense that, as Hal is kind of referring to here, if you have a strong magnetic field over here, a sunspot or something, as this ribbon starts to move into that region, it will slow down, almost stop. You can, in fact, use this motion, you can relate this motion to theory. Thinking about this has evolved over time. I'll just kind of show you the latest result of this. Just using Faraday's equation, you can relate the motion of flare ribbons to what I'm referring to as a global rate of reconnection. What it is, it's the voltage drop along the separator line, the entire X line. And you can relate that to the ribbon motion without having a detailed model of the coronal magnetic field. Here's a kind of diagram of an eruption in 3D. This is seen from above. So these black lines right in here with the arrows attached to them are the outer edges of the flare ribbons. And they're moving apart in that motion that I was showing you before. This dotted line is the polarity inversion line. And I've also drawn on here in these gray regions what would be the open fields. You would see this in something like EIT or YOCO as the appearance of transient coronal holes. So imagine that this whole region has erupted. It started to close back down, reconnect. You have loops spanning the ribbons here, and the ribbons move outwards with time. So this area A, or the area A prime, is essentially the flux, of newly reclosed flux. And the rate of change of that flux is essentially equal to the electric field along the reconnection line, the X line. You can also write it as the normal magnetic field in this region or that region out of the plane times the perpendicular velocity, the velocity defined as being perpendicular to the local curvature here, integrated along this entire loop. So you can actually get a voltage out of that. And I have an ongoing project with Karen Harvey to actually look at this for a two-ribbon flare, which occurred in 1998. This is the image from SOHO EIT. We're actually using 10-8-30 data to look at both the transient coronal holes and the ribbons. And she has looked at that event. This is a decaying active region. You get the magnetogram for it. You trace out the area swept out by the ribbons. Here's three different times. The red is early on. The ribbons, the polarity inversion line is through here. There's actually a prominence associated with this, so there's an erupting prominence as well. Later in time, the blue areas have been swept out, so there are loops spanning that area. And then a few hours later, the green area has been swept out. So you can measure the fluxes in those areas. And here is her measurement of that. This is for the eastern flare ribbon of that event I was showing you. So let me just show the bottom first. The bottom is just the raw area that you map out that the ribbons have been sweeping out with time. So they're growing apart, the area increases. And then you measure the magnetic flux inside those areas. And that's the top curve. And you can see that it's a little bit noisy, in the sense that it's wiggling up and down a little bit. To get the total voltage drop, you need to take the derivative of that curve. And because it's a little bit noisy, the derivative is a bit even more obviously noisy. But you get out This is the unsmooth curve here. This is a three-point convolution smoothing below. Basically, what you see is that you reach something like 6 times 10 to the 9th volts, which is a lot of voltage. If you think of this in terms of voltage which could accelerate energetic particles, it's you're getting up to 6 GeV for particle acceleration. But you have this rapid, this big peak in the electric field, which lasts about 10 or 15 minutes at the beginning, a big impulse, followed by a low level of reconnection later on. And I've looked, we're very curious about the noise here, and I'm more or less convinced at the moment that this noise is due to atmospheric seeing, because these are ground-based observations. It's possible that there's also a contribution from the granularity of the magnetogram, which I'm not really sure about yet. So it would be very nice to repeat this calculation with space-based data, which you don't have to worry about seeing. And the main point of this analysis is that over a 240-minute period, 4 hours, we have a big peak followed by a low level of reconnection afterwards. And I think, I will argue in the last remaining 5 minutes here, that that's basically a kind of indicator that the trigger mechanism for the eruption involves an ideal MHD process. I will show you one model which does this, but this is not the only, almost any model involving an ideal MHD process will do this. It's not support for this particular model. But here's a 2D flux rope model in which the field before the eruption is in the form of a helical flux rope sitting here. The red indicates the current in the flux rope. There's also a current sheet associated with this that's not so obvious because it's really in the boundary layer. And so there's magnetic energy associated with this system. You can cause it to erupt by moving the sources of the photospheric field here, which in this model are two-point sources. You move them together, and the height of the flux rope versus the separation distance of these sources, lambda here, that changes slowly with time and reaches a point where equilibrium is no longer possible. The system erupts. As it erupts, it forms a current sheet. The current sheet doesn't actually appear until after the eruption is already underway. It appears very shortly, though. And you then, if you have rapid reconnection, the system can escape outwards to infinity. If you don't get any reconnection, it won't escape. It'll be trapped. This current sheet will prevent the escape of the system. So you have to have reconnection. And no matter, I will show you just shortly here, that no matter what, for any value you want to assume for the reconnection rate, which is realistic, namely, I consider anything realistic where the inflow Alfvén Mach number is less than 1, it's inconceivable to me that it could be greater than 1. And most people think it's like 0.1 or 0.01. For any small value, you tend to get a particular signature. Before I show you that signature, let me just show that, again, you can use this as a guide for simulations. This is a simulation where color here is basically temperature. It's a little more complicated than that. I've also unfolded pressure, thermal energy density into it. But here's a flux rope sitting initially at equilibrium. It becomes unstable, very, very slowly starts to rise and expand. Heating starts to occur. You get a reconnection site here. You get jets. You even get fast mode shocks in here. You get slow shocks. The thing goes out. And what happens during that eruption, what's called the current filament here, is the flux rope, which starts very slowly to move out of equilibrium, like a ball rolling off a hill. The X line appears, comes up. There's a shock wave which is generated because of the motion. And then the rate of reconnection, here measured as volts per centimeter, the electric field, again has this big spike followed by something afterwards. Now, unfortunately, in the simulation, you can't follow it in time. This is only about 2 minutes of real time. And that data I was showing you was like 4 hours. What happens in the simulation is that the flux rope runs out of the top of the box and everything is finished. So to actually think about what happens in longer time, you can do a little analytical model in which you self-consistently specify the field and everything together, but you leave the rate of reconnection as arbitrary. You can use some model for it if you want. You can say there's turbulence, or you could use Petchek or Sweet Park or whatever you like. And when you do that, you get out this electric field, which would be equivalent to the voltage in the observations. A big spike initially, which is the ideal MHD process creating that sheet, slamming things together, followed by a long decay process where that current sheet gradually disappears via reconnection. This is one where I assume that the rate of reconnection was constant at about 0.1. You could say that's kind of quasi, kind of like a turbulent type model. But it doesn't really matter which kind of reconnection model you use, they all have this behavior. Okay, let me terminate pretty quickly here. So, what roles does reconnection play in flares, in eruptions? Possible roles are storage, it could still be a trigger mechanism, and the energy release and field relaxation. I don't know why I have a question mark there. The first one should have a question mark, not the last one. Another important question that still needs to be investigated, what are the relative importance of kinetic and MHD process in the current sheet, and how do both work? I don't think you can argue that either one of them can be neglected. But I don't know which one, you know, exactly how they interact. That's a mystery to me. The other thing I'd like to point out here is how does reconnection work during the pulsing phase? I had a view graph, which I skipped here, showing that if you look at that initial eruption, the rate at which the current sheet is growing is almost at the Alphane speed. And that current sheet is far from being a steady state process. It's highly time dependent. So a lot of these steady state models like Sweet Parker or Petchek are not applicable. And you can estimate that it takes something like 30 minutes to an hour before the sheet would ever become steady state. So I don't really feel there's any theory that really covers the initial phase of the eruption. And then I had a view graph here, which maybe I should show, about trying to calculate the anomalous resistivity from observations. There's some observations by McKenzie and Hupson of outflows from a current sheet, mainly this outflow. There's observations recently from EIT by Yokoyama that seem to indicate an inflow into the sheet. And with a little bit of thinking, you can try to figure whether you could actually calculate the resistivity from the observations. You can see temperature, velocities, and sheet length. The problem is you don't know how thick this sheet is. And it's really hard to get N squared L and the angle of viewing, all of this from the observations, to get them separated from one another. So at the moment, you can't quite calculate the parameters that the theory needs from the observations. Okay, I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Terry, for leaving some time for discussion.
I'm not sure if you're aware of a piece of work by NGIT postdoc Dr. Q. It's using foot-pointing motion and measurement of B field to derive the V, and it matched with hard X-ray profile quite well.
Yeah, I talked to her. She showed me some of her results recently. Yeah, she was trying to do the same thing. I don't know how well it's working with a comparison to energetic particles. I think she was also trying to do that. If I'm thinking of the right paper.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Terry, if it were an ideal instability that starts the whole thing off, would you expect in that case that the the evolution you observe will always be very fast initially, that you'll see things moving at the Alphane speed, like, you know, you see a kinking or something. But often, you know, these events, they start off with the prominence rising quite slowly. You don't really, it doesn't look like.
Not necessarily.
Ideal instability.
Because, as I was kind of showing here in this simulation, if you have an equilibrium which becomes unstable, it can take quite a while for the instability to grow, depending on the level of the noise. And when you put in, like, say, photospheric convection as the disturbing noise, you can actually get times like a pre fast eruption phase of something like 10 minutes. So I've actually been criticized in other ways, saying that people who don't know solar observations very well, saying, well, gee, if you use a process like this, it's going to have a slow development phase first, because it takes a while for it to develop any motion. And in fact, such slow development phases do exist prior to eruption. So, yeah, the question of a growth phase. And I mentioned here an ideal MHD instability. I tried to be careful and say that it involves an ideal MHD instability, because you could have an interplay of reconnection as a trigger and ideal. You could imagine, this is something I think Dick is almost going to get to this afternoon, talking about emerging flux as a trigger. You can imagine reconnection going on and gradually destabilizing the system by changing moving field lines around. And that would actually cause the system to get to some point where it was ideal. So you could have a reconnection playing a role and leading to an ideal MHD process in the eruption. It doesn't have to be exclusively ideal.
But that current sheet you formed, though, that initial strong current sheet, that was from an ideal.
In this case, in this particular example. But I would think if you did another kind of hybrid model, it would look very much the same for in terms of the high peak electric field.
Just a comment regarding the role of reconnection. I would like to point to another possibility which you did not mention. It's a forced reconnection. So, briefly speaking, what is going on if you shear the field and then you have some another deformation by converging photoelectric motion, and then you trigger reconnection and you reduce all the energy which was stored by shearing. And this scenario doesn't require any threshold, so don't have any instability you need.
Yeah, I was just giving some examples there.
And it looks very natural for such a system, because you always have a perturbation of the coronal field continuously.
Yeah, that's certainly possible.
So why is not
possible? I was just giving some examples, illustrative examples of how a threshold process might work, you know, as a trigger. But that was not an exclusive list. Yeah, okay.
We had a graduate student, Ian Sammons, who decided he'd learn about flares, and he looked at 10 years' worth of data, and he found that every last flare above X4 was a delta spot, and about 95% of the X flares were delta spots. Now, a delta spot, the original Kunzel thing, Kunzel actually observed flares and found that what was important was what was going on down in the sunspot. I think this emphasis on the coronal structure is entirely misplaced. I think the Koppen-Newman model, which is so popular, has nothing to do with flares, and because it refers to bipolar structures. And flares are not simple bipolar spots. Flares are delta spots. And we know that. It's a very important observational fact. We know that we observe very strong transverse fields in these spots, which is just set up for carrying mode instabilities. And that's why it can happen so fast. The fields are very strong. The scales are very small. The coronal stuff is all consequential. Now, of course, you've showed one class with that July 29, 1973 event. That is not a typical impulsive or X flare. That's an old active region where the filament finally erupts and you get a stupid flare. But it's the delta spot. It's how is the delta spot formed, and what is the characteristic of the currents in the delta spot that trigger the flares? And you've got to do even better than 1,000 seconds. You've got to be closer to a few hundred seconds.
Yeah, I've focused, as you're rightly saying, I'm focused here on large scale structures. If you want to put a flare to it, they'd be two ribbon flares in decaying active regions. I've done that because it's easier to see these large scale structures and to talk about flows and things. I think my feeling is that the same principles are involved in delta spots. That is, you still have currents flowing in the corona. The energy has to be released from them somehow. And if you actually want to model the delta spot eruptions, you're going to have to use a different geometry. So I can't disagree with you on that. And it's going to be perhaps more confined.
We know roughly what the geometry is. You have the delta configuration of two spots of opposite polarity, and then you have an enormously strong transverse field connecting them. In fact, the transverse field in these delta spots is equal to the sunspot, to the vertical sunspot. It's about 3,000 Gauss or more, rather than these biddly but I don't think I've seen anyone try to model that structure.
What is your dose of inspiration, Gary?
Okay, yes, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. We better get on to the next talk.